The morning of August 21st, 1911, Paris, France. Workers arrived to the Louvre to find the most valuable piece of art in the world, the Mona Lisa, has been stolen. The most famous art theft of all time will be discussed for over a century. Who stole the Mona Lisa and how? And why is this piece so priceless? This week on Unknown Passage, we look at the origins of Leonardo da Vinci's masterpiece and its endless mysteries, as well as her notorious theft and many vandalisms. Prime resources for this episode are NPR, DePaul University, The Guardian, Caltech, the University of Paris Nanterre, Smithsonian Magazine, the BBC, The New Yorker, and Vanity Fair. Hi guys, welcome back to episode 137 of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. I told you I would, if I could, bring you a bonus episode a couple of times this month, so here I am, I'm delivering for you. I've worked on this episode for, well, writing it down about a month, but I was waiting for the right opportunity to kind of change the pace a little bit of the podcast and take a break from all the doom and gloom for a week. And then someone decided to smear cake on the Mona Lisa when they were disguised as an old woman in a wheelchair as some sort of stunt. And I thought, now's the time. And that was probably about a month and a half ago now. So I will get into all of that, especially in part two. But first off, I want to welcome new patrons since the last episode, Kendra and Caitlin. Welcome. Now I'm going to get straight into this. It's going to be a two-parter. And patron Valerie, for her location request, she just said I can do any case I want for her request. So I'm making this her request. And considering she's really fond of Italy and has spent quite a lot of time there, I felt like it was fitting. Valerie is listening with her two beautiful kitty cats, Luca and Claire, from Cleveland, Ohio. She used to live in Texas. She's traveled a lot across the world, across the US extensively, Canada, Mexico, the Bahamas, Jamaica, across Europe, spent most of her time in Europe, in Italy, and has also been to Japan. And she's just really cool, and I'm glad she's a patron. So this is for you, Valerie. Now, we've been to Italy before for an assault on the very famous Michelangelo sculpture, the Pietà, by Australian Laszlo Toth. And that kind of gave way to a new subcategory on Unknown Passage at the time, which is one of my favorite topics, art theft and art in particular. Now, this episode covers arguably the most famous ever art theft and the origins of the subject of the theft and why people want to get their hands on this woman so badly. It's kind of less about the person who did it and more about the many journeys of the Mona Lisa and all the times she's been moved around and traveled around, when people have been successful in stealing her, how she's been moved in secret to protect her. So if art really isn't your thing, you will have to wait till the next episode, but maybe if you give it a listen, it might surprise you. This is just a girl who was born in Italy. She moved to France and she was just trying to chill out in her new home when she was abruptly taken from it. So I felt like it would suit the podcast. I've had to rein myself in so many times being a nerd on this episode because I love so many facets of what I'm about to talk about. I get really geeky about it. I love Paris. One of my main clients is in Paris, so I write extensively about Paris weekly. I have been to Paris. It's one of my favorite cities. I love Italy. We also go there. I love history. I love art, although I wish I knew more about the technicalities of art. I don't know kind of the actual methods of art, and I can't draw to save myself. I wish, and I could just go on forever about these things, and I love artists, and I think they're fascinating. And like on the Pieta episode about Laszlo Toth, where I talked a fair bit about Michelangelo, I hope that you get something out of this in regards to talking about Leonardo da Vinci, because he's such an important man in history. He cannot be understated in terms of how important he is. And that's the reason why 600 years on, people still talk about him so much. So I just want to give two particular shout outs to two people who actually wrote theses for their universities that I used in part one, particularly talking about Paris and poverty in Paris at the turn of the century. And the first one's called What About the Poor? 19th Century Paris and the Revival of Vincentian Charity by Edward R. Udovic for DePaul University. And the second one is The Democratization of Longevity, How the Poor Became Old in Paris, 1870 to 1940 by Lionel Ketzenbaum, Jean Laurent Rosenthal for Caltech in 2012. So, the first place we're going to go to for part one is the city of Paris, France, an incredible city that I'm sure many of you listening have been to. And people are often really torn when you talk to them. They either love Paris or they hate it. It's a really polarizing city. But 1911, it was a different city altogether. In 1911, Paris was a world city, a city of creatives, bohemians, and artists. At this stage, it's at the tail end of the Belle Epoque period, which ran over the previous four decades. This is a time that translates to the beautiful time. It's a time when the city of Paris prospered. It drew in visitors from all over, and it truly established itself as a global force to be reckoned with. People were optimistic and many people prospered financially. The Paris World's Fair of 1889 saw the erection of the Eiffel Tower as a landmark, and Parisians saw this tower as a complete eyesore. They hated it, and it was only meant to be up for between 10 and 20 years after the World's Fair, but today it still stands and many of you have probably looked at it or climbed it. In 1900, Paris held the Olympics and various world exhibitions, which only solidified it as a world city. For the wealthy during this period, life was good and Paris was the place to be. There wasn't a war during La Belle Epoque. Women wore beautiful dresses, men wore top hats and suits and tailored suits. Horse-drawn carts filled the streets of Paris, and the city was rapidly becoming more and more modernized and one of the most modern cities in the world. It was really rivaling London in terms of how it was progressing. Artistic neighborhoods like Montmartre would be instated as the bohemian destinations they still are considered today, home to the Moulin Rouge and the origin of can-can dancing. Terrace culture, which is essentially just sitting and people watching while you have a drink. Artists, writers, and fellow creatives flocked here to find their people, often living in poverty to do so, but some not so much. The movie Midnight in Paris is a really beautiful movie. I love it. And it really is special in a sense that it transports you back in a really beautiful way to La Belle Epoque. And it really was a beautiful time, at least for the rich of Paris. But for the poor or the less well-off, Paris was hell during this period and for decades after. And for many, it still is today, as it's one of the richest cities with a very big gap between the rich and the poor. And it's incredibly expensive to live in Paris. One of my favourite novels of all time is George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London. I think it's one of his most undervalued and underappreciated works, next to 1984 and Animal Farm, and Down and Out in Paris and London was published in 1933, but it didn't get a lot of attention. But technically, it's one of George Orwell's first pieces, and it's based on his memoirs of living in both Paris and then London in the 20s, in his 20s, for a time, to see what it was like to live in poverty. George Orwell did not come from a poor family. He came from quite a wealthy family in England. And he decided to go with nothing to see how basically the other half lived, almost like an experiment. And he compares the two. So the first half of the book, he speaks of his time living in Paris and basically sleeping in rooming houses and working as a waiter. It's very reminiscent of how Anthony Bourdain wrote, actually. And I don't know if Anthony Bourdain ever read George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London. But then George Orwell goes on to London and finds it probably a lot more difficult, really. He sleeps in parks and he talks about, you know, the darkness of how people basically would pay whatever the currency was at the time, you know, a penny or something, and they would sleep leaning against ropes in order to be inside, and they would just be ropes strung up and you would lean against them, and that was basically if you couldn't afford a room for the night or housing, which is how a lot of people lived. Paris, though, was both the richest and poorest city in the world at the time, with 73% of its population considered poor at the turn of the century. And sadly, life in Paris was not a meritocracy. Old money was everything at the turn of the century, and people from old money judged the nouveau riche, which were people with new money, as much as they judged the poor. According to 5MinuteHistory.com, quote, in 1890, 11 million of the nation's 12 million families earned less than $1,200 per year. Of this group, the average annual income was $380, well below the poverty line, unquote. The French Revolution a century before had stemmed from inequality at its core, but the bloodshed hadn't achieved much by the turn of the century. Like in London at the time when Jack the Ripper stalked the streets of Whitechapel in London, poor people lived in slums. Victor Hugo had written in 1862 in his masterpiece Les Misérables of the city of the period, and Les Misérables literally translates to the miserable ones. Baths were an annual event. It was around once a year that people would bath at the time. Homes were filthy and overcrowded. Tenancy laws didn't exist, and you could be evicted with 1 minute's notice. In 1901 alone, according to Alaine Faure, up to 10,000 Parisians were expelled with no notice onto the streets of Paris. And I guess to reference something that would kind of be relatable to some people, I guess, in the musical Les Mis, I guess the character of Fantine, who goes from working in a factory or a workshop to ending up being, you know, a prostitute on the streets of Paris, is probably a good representation of life for especially a lot of women at the time. Privacy didn't exist in households. Women did not have careers. Disease and malnutrition were rife, even amongst the more wealthy. The life expectancy in Paris was 50 at the turn of the century. And basically, if you were living below the poverty line, you could probably expect to live around 10 to 12 years less than those who lived in the better neighbourhoods of Paris, who would probably live till about 60. The sewerage system in Paris only began to be established in 1870, but clean water wouldn't reach all the households in Paris for another 60 years. And if you've ever been to a city that's often built on hills, like parts of Paris are, or Edinburgh in particular in Scotland, I did a tour there one of the times I went to Edinburgh. And they talked about how the whole city is built on hills. So when people would dispose of their sewage pre-sewage system, it would just roll down the hill. So you can imagine kind of the disease that was rife all across the world. And I mean, still exists today in parts of the world. Homelessness in Paris was rife. Orphanages were everywhere and full of babies and children. The Catholic Church had been reinstated in 1801, and they believed that a return to order would be found through Christianity, and they didn't understand all the modern components that, or refused to understand the modern components that went into a lot of the reason why so much of the city was living in poverty in this dawning of an industrial age. The St. Vincent de Paul Society actually came out of this time in Paris. Eventually, laws were passed that completely separated church and state, and today France is maybe the world's most famous secular nation. A lot of artists drew inspiration from the, you know, Miserables of Paris. Artists like Manet painted the prostitutes or sex workers of Paris, as well as the paupers of the city, albeit on a very superficial level where there wasn't a lot of depth into, I don't even know how to describe it, but I was reading kind of a comparison between Manet and other artists and how Manet couldn't possibly have understood his subjects because he wasn't living amongst them. And in a sad kind of way, it reminded me of Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic, how he lived amongst the, you know, French prostitutes and drew them. The French government of the time really didn't care. According to Edward Ludovic in his thesis, I'm going to read you quite a lengthy excerpt from it, quote, throughout this era, successive French governments denied any necessity for increasing public spending on behalf of relief of the poor, whose very numbers and existence they consistently underestimated, discounted, or denied. As far as the government was concerned, true, unblameworthy poverty affected only a relatively small number of what were, in fact, an increasingly mythical class of those who had been described traditionally as a comfortable clientele of honest, of artisans, old folk, widows, and nursing babes. These groups alone were considered to be the industrious and deserving poor, who represented a population which it was assumed could be supported easily and minimally without any further bothersome increases in government expenditure or attention. For the government and its ruling classes, the problem of poverty came to be related only to an infinitesimal number of people and was thus stripped of all its gravity and horror. But as Alain Faure wrote in his thesis, Local Life in Working Class Paris at the End of the 19th Century, the poor had a sense of community that the upper crust didn't, and that worked to their advantage in a sense that they could shoulder the burden between close community, despite the fact that you were sharing with all these people you didn't know. Life was finite, and it was also every day was precarious, and you were always living on the edge of losing everything. They still had the sense of community, and he talked about, you know, people getting together and laughing. And you do see that a lot in countries that are quite poor, the sense of community that other countries just don't have. In 1911 in particular, a new industrial age was forging ahead, but World War I was on the horizon, and this period of relative peace would be brutally upended for the French. 2 million French citizens would die during World War I, which equated to around 5% of the population. And at this time, crime was experiencing a spike. During his reign that ended in 1815 at the Battle of Waterloo, Napoleon Bonaparte had established many public parks and gardens and museums during his reign. He basically one of the things that Napoleon was very passionate about was liberal policies. He's often met with a lot of kind of criticism over the years, but you still can't deny what he did for Paris and for France on the whole before he was exiled to St. Helena. And basically, he took museums such as the Louvre, which were once reserved for the aristocracy, the upper crust, and royalty. And the Louvre at the time had the largest collection of art in the world, and it still does. And the public were not allowed to see it. They weren't considered good enough to see art that dated back, you know, centuries. And one of the things that Napoleon did was to make these public museums so that anybody could visit them. And he also instituted a lot of public parks because, again, parks, you know, in particular in the grounds of the Tuileries Palace and things like that were all private gardens. So a lot of the things that you can visit today in Paris, on top of monuments that he created, which are pretty much odes to the power of the French and pride, which is one of the things that, you know, Parisians have in spades, pride in their city, and the French, you can kind of thank Napoleon for that. And the Louvre, as I was getting to, the Louvre Museum in Paris, which is the most visited museum today in the world still, had the largest collection. And basically one of the first things Napoleon did was make sure that the Musée du Louvre would be allowed, the public would be allowed access to it to see all these works. And it was on August 21st, 1911, a Monday morning, that workers at the Louvre arrived to find the frame holding the world's most famous painting, the 500-year-old Mona Lisa by Leonardo da Vinci, with a worth of almost $1 billion monetarily today, but basically priceless, empty. In fact, the frame and the painting's protective case had been completely removed off the wall and was positioned in a nearby stairwell. And there's a picture of the empty frame, and for when you're an art lover and for the curators of this gallery and for the maintenance people and the staff and, you know, just the understanding of how important this piece was, it's such a shocking picture to see just two paintings on either side of it and then four pegs, and the entire case has been removed off the wall. This painting was the centerpiece of the Louvre, and today it still is. The acquisition of it was a major coup for the French, and it had been basically in pride of place in the Parisian Museum since 1797, and now it was gone. Frantically, the staff called the police. Now, I felt it would be weird to kind of set up this situation in Paris at the time and how a lot of people were living, and then just discuss the theft of this piece without discussing the importance of the piece. So this is where I'm going to take us back centuries before the theft of the Mona Lisa, five centuries actually, to a small town called Vinci, which is about 20 miles outside of the city of Florence in the region of Tuscany, Italy. Leonardo di Ser Piero da Vinci was born on April 15th, 1452, in the town of Vinci. Essentially, names in Italy often translate literally to son of and then of the name of the place. So essentially, it's Leonardo, son of Piero, of Vinci. I knew more about Michelangelo, who I touched on in the episode of Laszlo Toth, but my general knowledge of Leonardo da Vinci was quite sparse. So researching this, I just really fell in love with him. I knew he was an incredible man for his time. He's the definition of a Renaissance man, someone, you know, who has an interest in everything. But I'd done tours in Florence. I've been to Florence twice, and one of my best friends from university. She lives in Florence now, and when she first moved there in 2013, I went again to visit her, and she actually got into an art school in Florence, which is quite hard to get into, and she's so talented. And it was just like, oh, you're studying art in Florence. It's the center of the art world. This is where all of the greats came from. You know, what an incredible experience. So Florence is essentially was the place to be for art, and it really still is to this day. And many of the most famous pieces in Italy can be found in Florence, including the Statue of David by Michelangelo, which is in a museum called the Accademia. And there's also the Uffizi Gallery, which is a really huge gallery, which is incredible. And they've got quite a lot of Michelangelo and Da Vinci's works there. And there was quite a tussle over the Mona Lisa. Should she be in the Uffizi or the Louvre? Because she is an Italian piece who, you know, resides in Paris. For a brief intro into Leonardo da Vinci, he was born in 1452 into a situation that at the time would have been a very big deal. He was born as an illegitimate child. His mother was considered low class. They don't know very much about her. She was 20 at the time he was born, and he wrote prolifically throughout his life, and he often refers to her as Caterina, but sometimes as Catalina. She was considered lower class, and his father was a local notary, a step up from lower class, and he was 30 at the time, but the two of them weren't married, and his father was already betrothed, as they put it, to another woman, so he was due to get married. Now, you can imagine what Caterina at the time would have gone through as a basically having a child out of wedlock in 1452, but it actually seems like she managed to skirt a lot of the issues that a lot of women would have faced, I guess, thanks to the fact that Leonardo's father actually came from a family with a bit of money. And a lot of historians believe that he was actually able to either have her sent away, which was usually what happened, in order to give birth. But somehow, and they're not entirely sure because it was such a long time ago, and a lot of the time historians can only go off writings of the time, and in particular Leonardo da Vinci's writings. But basically, they did not marry, and they never married, which would be bucking the trend as well. Instead, when Leonardo was about one, both of his parents married other people, and his mother married a local craftsman, and his father married the woman that he was already engaged to, a woman called Albira. Now, she died, his stepmother, when Leonardo was about 12, and his father would actually remarry three times after that, which would have been a big deal. And from all of these marriages that his father had, Leonardo da Vinci would have 16 half-siblings. And the infant mortality rate, you know, back then in particular, was incredibly high. The life expectancy wasn't even that high. And 11 of them survived infancy, which was quite a large percentage. The age gaps, because his father kept marrying until he was old himself and was marrying younger women, would mean that when the youngest one was born, Leonardo da Vinci was 46 years old. But he wouldn't really have much contact with his father throughout his life. What we know about Leonardo was that growing up, we don't know much about his childhood, but we do know that he was raised by his mother, Caterina, and his father was actually in his life to an extent, and he was actually close to his father's brother, his uncle, and he was also close to, I believe, his grandparents as well. As was the time, Leonardo da Vinci received very little formal education, which makes him even more impressive and what he achieved in his life. And as was also the way back then, art was a highly respected industry. And as with Michelangelo, if children showed artistic capabilities at a young age, their parents would often kind of forget about formal education, maths, or I guess Italian instead of English in this case, and usually nurture the creative aspect, which often meant that they would go on to work in a studio, starting out as kind of like an intern almost, a studio hand for a local artist, and then they would graduate to being an apprentice, and then they would become a master after probably, you know, almost 20 years themselves or 10 years. So at 14, like his contemporary Michelangelo, he was a student hand for a famous Florentine artist, Andrea di Verrocchio. Now, this was big. Verrocchio had learnt under one of the greatest artists of all time, and an institution in Florence who, from memory, Michelangelo also had links to, which was Donatello. And eventually Leonardo da Vinci became an apprentice, and that was well into his 20s. And around the time, another apprentice in the same studio was Botticelli, who would be most famous for painting the curvy women of the time. Now, I think that was Botticelli. It was, wasn't it? I know that Botticelli, I always think of women with curly hair. Botticelli. Or was it Rubens? I'm pretty sure it was Botticelli. Despite having very little formal education in written Italian or maths, Leonardo da Vinci wrote extensively throughout his life, and many of these writings, or I guess they're more just thoughts he put down in notebooks instead of journal entries, they remain today. During an artistic apprenticeship under Verrocchio in Florence, in particular, Michelangelo learnt it all, which is what you would if you were given an apprenticeship under a master. And training was intense and varied. You didn't just do drawing and painting. You did sculpture, modelling, leather work, woodwork, metal work. You studied science and chemistry and biology, woodwork. Painting and drawing, you worked with different materials. You worked on parchment and wood and canvas and gold. You worked with gold leaf and fresco. And they basically, anyone who worked under a master would ultimately, a lot of the time, become a master themselves. An early piece that Verrocchio and Da Vinci worked on together is called The Baptism of Christ, which you may know if you looked at it, which is now on display in the Uffizi Gallery. At the age of 20, Leonardo da Vinci, with no formal education and an illegitimate child, was classified as a master. To describe Leonardo da Vinci, it's complicated. You can really go off what his own students later on, how they would describe him in writings when he would become more famous. They believe that they have his remains, but it's never been confirmed. But based on those remains, they believe he was around 5'7" and that he had a quote unquote unusually large skull. But considering his IQ was around 180 to 220, I don't know, maybe his brain was massive. What we do know is that there are a few drawings of him, a few portraits, one of which I've made the episode picture. If you're listening on Spotify, that is a self-portrait, probably the most famous. I believe it's chalk by Leonardo da Vinci of himself when he was in his early 60s. But as he aged, we do know that he wore his hair long, which was generally against the grain because men generally kept quite short cropped hair. Men at the time were also clean-shaven generally, but he had a long beard. And some historians believe in his youth he had red hair that ultimately went grey. When long men wore long garments that were in kind of muted colours, Leonardo da Vinci would wear really colourful, bright clothing. And he was also super strong. And as much as he was a left-hander, which was also, not only is it only 1 in 10 people are left-handers, like myself, it seems that he was ambidextrous, which I actually am too. I write with my left hand and I can't even hold a pen with my right hand, but I do everything else with my right hand. I have more strength in my right to do everything else, including sports and things, but I have more strength in my left. I can only write with my left. And it seems that actually Leonardo da Vinci was the same. According to one of his confidants, Vasari, who would write a memoir after da Vinci died, Leonardo da Vinci, quote, possessed great strength and dexterity, being physically so strong that he could withstand violence, and with his right hand, he could bend the ring of an iron door knocker or a horseshoe as if they were lead, unquote. And that indicates the way that he's written that he used his right hand for a lot of things, because most of the time you wouldn't have the strength in your right, but he did. So that's how they kind of presume that he was right-handed. Today, they estimate Leonardo da Vinci's IQ to be around 180 to 220, which would put him as one of the most intelligent people of all time. And he was unique and really likable. When I was in Italy, I did a walking tour in Florence, and they talked a lot about the Medici family and Da Vinci. And I think I mentioned it on the Laszlo Toth episode, but Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci both came from Florence at the same time, although I think Da Vinci was a bit older than Michelangelo. And everyone respected Da Vinci. He was a kind man, he was generous. He wasn't uppity, no matter how many massive commissions he got, or who he worked with, or how much his career progressed. And he was always smiling and stopping to chat to people. And he just was a very, like, gentle, giving, kind man. Michelangelo, on the other hand, was bitter, angry pretty much his entire life. They'd had pretty much similar upbringings, albeit Michelangelo wasn't born an illegitimate child. He actually had a lot of things that Leonardo da Vinci did not have growing up, but he got more embittered as he got older. And they would often kind of run into each other in the street, according to this tour guide I had, this older woman who was great. And Michelangelo would kind of grunt at da Vinci, you know, and da Vinci would be like, oh, here he is again, this dickhead. But I respect them both. Da Vinci was different. On top of being left-handed, he was also vegetarian, which by choice, which was rare for the time as well. He set up his own workshop after he became a master, and the commissions started flowing in. Back then, you took commissions from, you know, well-heeled people, aristocracy. You often went and worked for the Pope, which is how Michelangelo ended up painting the Sistine Chapel. And at the time, Italy, I'm not going to get into it, but it was very complicated. And at one point, Venice, you know, was completely separate to Italy, and the Pope went into hiding, and there was a war, a civil war in Italy, and all these things. So I'm just kind of glossing over all of that. Otherwise, I'd be here forever. But he painted important pieces that now have pride of place in Florence landmarks like the Uffizi Gallery and the Piazza Vecchio. And he was regularly did commissions for the powerful Medici family, who were basically, you know, Italy's, not just Italy, but Europe's most powerful family for generations. Da Vinci never married nor had children, which a lot of people talk about. But I don't believe Michelangelo did either. And I find that's quite a common thread amongst the masters. They kind of dedicated their whole lives to the craft. So we don't actually have a direct descendant of Leonardo da Vinci. However, Smithsonian Magazine reported in 2021 that genealogists had located 14 living relatives of Leonardo da Vinci through his siblings, because he had so many of them. Some still have the family name Da Vinci and are ordinary people living in Tuscany. And when you branch it out a little bit more to the closest 35, the filmmaker Franco Zeffirelli, who made the 70s version of Romeo and Juliet, which I love, he is one of them. They located only one living relative today who is an artist. The rest are just accountants and have other non-artistic jobs. This artist is a 62-year-old called Giovanni Vinci, and he was shocked to be told that he was a descendant of Leonardo da Vinci. But he was modest about it. He said to Smithsonian Magazine, quote, "Maybe for some of my works, Leonardo turned in his grave, but for the rest, I hope he is proud," unquote. But in regards to his personal life, there is strong evidence that Leonardo da Vinci, I keep going to say DiCaprio, that's so bad, although he was named after Leonardo da Vinci, so I don't know. There appears to be evidence that Leonardo da Vinci was either gay or bisexual, but most likely gay, and that he almost was jailed for sodomy in his 20s when he was about 24. So this is really terrible. In Florence at the time, there was basically like a morality police, the kind of thing you'd see in Saudi Arabia or Dubai today. They had anonymous letterboxes throughout Florence where people could leave basically like blind items or just name the people. And they could leave letters outing people for doing immoral things, and they could do it anonymously, which if someone hated you, it would take nothing just to write something that was a lie. And so one of these letterboxes that was there was at the town hall in Florence. And when Leonardo da Vinci was 24, an anonymous letter was left there that said that a local artist's model who regularly modeled for artists, but was also known to be a local male prostitute, had been having affairs with four local men. And one of them was Leonardo da Vinci. The rest were, one was kind of a wealthy merchant and a couple of other everyday guys. Ultimately, the men were arrested, and the charges were dropped against all men. Now, the penalty at the time for sodomy was the death penalty across Europe, but in Florence, convictions for it were less than in other places. They had a bit more of a relaxed attitude towards it, which actually gave way to, in Germany, them having a term which was Florenzen or something, which basically was like a nasty word for gay men that used the name Florence as the translation, if you get me. But basically, once the charges were dropped against these four men, another letter appeared in this letterbox reiterating the charges again. And these were dismissed again. And historians have kind of looked at this and think that it's not because Da Vinci was powerful or a local master, but because he was one of four men who were listed on this letter, and one of the men had quite powerful family connections in Florence, that it was dropped as a result of that. Now, if you think of, you know, the butterfly effect, imagine that Leonardo da Vinci at that point in time in his life had been put to death for being gay, for the act of sodomy. How much the world would be different considering the number of things that he invented. It's crazy to think about. But basically, some historians believe that this experience made a gay Leonardo da Vinci become celibate forever. And there's a lot of writings. He didn't openly talk about his sexuality in his journals and things like that. He only references a couple of times about his sexuality. One of them he writes, quote, "The act of procreation and anything that has any relation to it is so disgusting that human beings would soon die out if there were no pretty faces and sensuous dispositions," unquote. And a lot of people think that he ended up being asexual as a result of this experience, that it jarred him so much and scared him so much that he had to look like he was asexual or celibate. But when you look into his paintings and sculptures, a lot of art historians look at them as having quite overtly gay themes. And I guess in the sense that Dan Brown with the Da Vinci Code kind of tried to read into the Vitruvian Man and things like that as having all these deep meanings, you can also look into them in terms of having like homosexual themes. And he regularly drew things that kind of pushed the limits, including men with erections in drawings and things like that. And if you believe what a lot of people kind of look at the Last Supper and things like that, there would be anti-church sentiment, depending on if that's what you see. A lot of people disagree with that. A lot of people see it. Or there would be in the Last Supper, for instance, a woman is sitting with the disciples. A lot of people believe it's a woman. And as they talk about in the Da Vinci Code, the V symbol where she's leaning to one side and the disciple next to her is leaning towards another side creates the V, which is like a reference to vaginas. Sometimes, I don't know, maybe, you know, these people do this for a living, but maybe you just see what you want to see. Many other pieces have very strong androgynous themes. At 32, Leonardo da Vinci moved to Milan. Here he worked for almost 20 years. This is where he painted The Last Supper, one of his most famous pieces, and one that many read into. He also drew at this time The Vitruvian Man, which, again, Dan Brown used, you know, to whatever end in the Da Vinci Code. And the actual Vitruvian Man is on display in the Accademia in Florence, which I've seen. And if you go to the Accademia, you can also visit the Statue of David because he's the main kind of draw card of that museum. The drawing, the Vitruvian Man, represents what Leonardo da Vinci considered the ideal human body proportions. Because on top of being an artist and a sculptor and a painter and a drawer, he was also, you know, a budding scientist and was very interested in engineering and architecture and biology and all of these different things. He then moved on to Venice and ultimately returned to Florence in the year 1500 at the age of 48. He continued to take commissions, and he also worked with various popes and leaders and often worked in creating or, you know, drawing up drafts for military engineering to improve kind of military technology. There was no kind of end to what he was able to do. He ultimately returned to Florence in 1503, and it was then at the age of 51 that he set about, unbeknownst to him, working on what would become his most famous piece and the most famous work of art in the world over 500 years later, the Mona Lisa. He would work on it for years, and in fact, when he died, a lot of art historians believe it's actually unfinished what you see at the Louvre today. The Mona Lisa itself is the subject of entire books, years-long PhDs. Art history experts spend a lifetime just talking about this one piece. And I will say straight up, what most people say when they see the Mona Lisa in person is they are shocked by how tiny it is. You expect it to be this life-size, you know, the size of a wall. You expect it to be larger than life, because every depiction of it is larger than life, but it's tiny. When you see, I'll put a picture of me up in the Patreon with it, and it's the worst picture ever because I didn't have an iPhone at the time and the quality's so bad. It's just me and then a ton of tourists behind me and then like a dot on the wall. It's only 30 by 21 inches, which is only 77 by 53 centimeters. It's in this giant thick glass case now behind a barrier, and the case totally dwarfs the piece of art. It is crazy, like the amount of barriers you have to get through to get by it, but because people have acted crazy and greedy in history, it has to be that way when other pieces of art don't have that level of security around it. But because it's worth, you know, $1 billion, but technically that monetary value, they can't even really calculate it. It's technically priceless. It just has to be that way. So the Mona Lisa is a portrait of a woman that Leonardo da Vinci painted onto poplar. Now, essentially, this is three slabs of wood, which was the general way they did it back in the time. It looks like a canvas, but it's like poplar plant, but it's wood. Now, it only weighs it's on part two on my second script. I believe it's £18 in total, and most of that is the canvas behind it. And then in total, once you add on the frame that's around it, especially in the year 1911, that takes up to over £200. So the frame and, you know, the canvas or what it's mounted on is most of its weight. In English, it's known as the Mona Lisa. In Italian, it's known as La Gioconda. In French, it's known as La Joconde. And all of these basically translate to happy or jovial. The origins of the Mona Lisa or who the Mona Lisa is have been debated for centuries. I think people were debating it when Da Vinci was painting her. Vasari, who was a fellow artist and a friend of Da Vinci and claimed to be there when Da Vinci died, maintained that Leonardo da Vinci was commissioned to paint it for a man in Florence called Francesco del Giocondo, of his wife, Mona Lisa, which is why in Italian it's called La Gioconda. Now, historians have long debated whether Leonardo da Vinci actually painted it at all. And I'll get into a few theories of whether it's a copy in part two. But in regards to it being a da Vinci in general, in 2005, it seemed that rumors that had abounded for centuries that he hadn't actually painted it were put to bed. Most art historians who are experts in this kind of thing and can tell whether something is by one artist just by looking at it, but through scans and all kinds of different things, had always said he did paint it. Many had said that they questioned whether or not he'd painted it. But in 2005, they found a book that basically in the margin of the book, there was a note by a contemporary of Da Vinci's from the time. And he had dated this note that he wrote 1503. And it basically, translated into English, says that Leonardo da Vinci at the time was working on a painting of Lisa del Gioconda, which kind of they take as clarification that yes, indeed, you know, he did paint it, and yes, it was of this wife of Francesco del Giocondo. But even the Louvre today says you can never be 100% sure that he painted it. But if we go with the widely held belief that it is Lisa del Gioconda, which a lot of people do, who was she? So Lisa del Gioconda, her husband Francesco, was a wealthy silk merchant in Florence, which would put them kind of upper class but not aristocracy. And generally Leonardo da Vinci only took commissions at this point later in his life from the aristocracy or popes. He was pretty much the most famous artist in the world. It would have been rare for him to take on a commission for a silk merchant because they still weren't kind of high enough. Not that he was a classist, but it's just the way things were. But Lisa herself came from one of Tuscany's most wealthy families even before she married Francesco del Giocondo. She was a noble woman. Basically, the story goes that to celebrate the arrival of their son and moving into a new house, her husband Francesco had commissioned a portrait of her from Leonardo da Vinci, and that's how the Mona Lisa came to be. Now, the other person that a lot of historians believe the painting could be is a woman called Isabella d'Este. Now, it's actually more likely that this could be her, even though widely, most people think that it's Lisa del Gioconda. And I don't even believe that Da Vinci ever called it Mona Lisa. I actually, from my understanding, it wasn't given that title till later. It wasn't given like a proper title because he hadn't finished it yet. So we don't actually know what he named it, which could be the key to the puzzle. But Isabella d'Este was a very prominent figure in Florence at the time, especially for a woman. Leonardo da Vinci knew her through her sister, and he'd actually drawn her before. There's actually a portrait by Da Vinci in the Louvre of Isabella d'Este, which would make it really weird if it turned out that she was the Mona Lisa and there's two in the same building of the same woman, but no one ever made the connection. The similarities are there, but the problem is with the one that we do know is Isabella d'Este. It's a drawing, it's in profile, so it's from the side. And let's be honest, everybody back in those ancient drawings looked, or paintings looked the same. They were not flattering, I don't think, of people's features. If you ever look at some of the really bad ones of royalty back in the day, there are also letters from Isabella to Leonardo da Vinci at the exact time he would have started working on the Mona Lisa around 1503, asking him repeatedly for an oil painting of herself, and trying to commission it. And she was sending it to agents that he worked with, as well as directly to himself. So she had that direct contact with him. Experts believe it makes more sense that a woman of basically such prominent means in Florence, like Isabella d'Este, would be the subject, because even if it was Lisa Gioconda who ordered it and her husband was wealthy, as I said, it's unlikely that Leonardo da Vinci would have taken on the job, as they weren't kind of prominent enough. No portrait of Lisa Gioconda exists, so we have nothing to compare Mona Lisa to if it was her. We only have a few descriptions of her. However, the one thing that could point away from Isabella d'Este, is that she is depicted in other portraits she had done of herself as having blonde hair, whereas the Mona Lisa has brown hair. There is a list of about 20 women art historians have put forward as potential subjects, and I personally don't think it matters all that much who she is. I don't personally think it's like it's an amazing piece of art. I don't fully understand the kind of lure around it. When I went to the Louvre, I was kind of like, oh, okay. Like, I've seen it before, and then I moved on. There's so many pe there's like 10,000 pieces of art at the Louvre. If you look at everything in the Louvre today for like 30 seconds, you'd be there for 2.5 years. I think that's the statistic. There's just so much to look at, including the Venus de Milo, which is another famous piece that's in the Louvre. And it's kind of, if you didn't know that it was Da Vinci and had all this lore around it, you'd kind of go, oh, it's just another portrait. But regardless of who it was, what makes the Mona Lisa so interesting are many facets. Many think she's a depiction of the Virgin Mary and read different religious connotations into it, or anti-religious connotations. How she's sitting, a lot of art historians read into it, and what she's sitting on, which until I read that, I didn't even ever notice in my, decades that she was ever sitting on anything. Things like that, I must have blindness. I don't notice details like that. The way her hands are placed in her lap, they believe, because her right hand is covering her left hand, that she could have been covering a wedding ring, or she could have been placed that way to show that she was a virgin. The background is kind of this mountainous landscape, which art historians have tried to place where it is in Italy, and they seem to have narrowed it down. She doesn't seem to have eyelashes or eyebrows, which a lot of people have read into. However, there's these scans that they can do now, which are kind of more of a modern thing, which protect the integrity of a piece of art, but are able to see the different layers of a canvas and the changes that have been done. And they've done these with the Mona Lisa. And these scans have shown that the Mona Lisa, at some point, she probably had eyelashes and eyebrows, but through the years, they've worn away. Scans also have found that the piece was changed a lot deliberately by Leonardo da Vinci over the between 3 years and 13 years he painted it, depending on what you believe. At one point, he altered the shape of her face. At one point, he altered the direction that her eyes were looking in. One of the things about her eyes, which is really interesting, is that they tend to move depending on where you are. At one point, she had a headdress on that was affixed by hairpins, but he'd scrubbed it off and removed it, and decided just to go with her hair being down with nothing over it. But it's her eyes and her half smile that have really entranced people and been the mystery for centuries. According to the BBC, a art historian from Harvard had basically done a research paper into the Mona Lisa, like a million other people. And she had found, and it's really hard for me to explain this, so I'm not going to try, but the phenomena is called foveal, F-O-V-E-A-L. And basically, the Mona Lisa's smile disappears depending on what direction you're looking in. And it's a trick of the eye. And if you look it up, it's to do with kind of the makeup of the eye. And they kind of wonder whether or not Leonardo da Vinci knew this because he was such an advanced man. And there's just layers and layers and layers within this painting that we'll never know. Ultimately, Leonardo da Vinci would travel back and forth to Milan and Rome, where he lived as a guest of the Pope for a while. Here, he cultivated yet another interest, botany. He also regularly dissected cadavers or dead bodies. He had a particular interest in vocal cords and general biology as well. He did extensive studies on water and hydraulics and created kind of early aqueducts. If you look up lists of things that he invented or drew the first of that are used today, it'll blow your mind. Maybe the most famous one is his flying machine. He was obsessed with flight, the thought of it, even before people were doing it, you know, hundreds of years before. And he invented this thing called like a ornithopter or something from memory. And it was basically the first flying machine, which would mean he invented the first aeroplane. Now, people today believe it wouldn't have worked, that it was too heavy and people couldn't have kept it afloat. But it was basically a pulley system where you, I believe, pedaled really fast and you took off. But they don't believe that people would have had kind of like human power enough, wouldn't have picked it up off the ground. But he never actually built it. He just drew that and he was just obsessed with birds and flight. He also invented the first parachute. That is true. And you can look up actual replicas of it online. He invented the first, kind of the equivalent of the first wetsuit or scuba suit. And it was basically when he was working in Venice for a time, and Venice was trying to, it was a port that was under threat from advancing armies, and they would use him to draw up different designs and engineer new ideas. And the diving suit, as it was called, was basically an early wetsuit with a snorkel and a mask and things like that, that would allow the Venetian military to walk underwater, walk on the floor, the seabed in Venice, and basically sabotage oncoming boats from other countries from under the water. He designed the first armored tank, which would have carried like, I think, 8 people. And this was long, long before cars. And he also designed a robotic knight, which is super futuristic for its time, and it could like talk and wave. And actually, the design for that, I was reading, went on to be the basis for technology that NASA has used. He was amazing. By this stage, though, Milan was actually under French rule, and Leonardo da Vinci was taken in by the French king, who was Francis I at the time, and he was given a chateau in central France. And you can visit that chateau, which is called Chateau de Clos Lucet. It's in the Loire Valley in France, in central France today. And I believe that's where they think that he was interred. And that's what they're basing his skeleton on, because when he died, that's where he was. And at the time that he went to the chateau to live, he took the Mona Lisa with him. Leonardo da Vinci started having regular strokes. Only a couple of portraits by others, as I said, of Da Vinci remain. One is by the Italian painter Giovanni Ambrogio Figino. And this is around the time that Leonardo da Vinci is about 65 years old. And in the painting, he's depicted as his right arm is wrapped up in clothing. And they believe at this stage that he was paralyzed from having a number of strokes. And so it was covering up, you know, the paralytic nature of his hand, how it was probably kind of tensed up. So that's how he was painted. Leonardo da Vinci died on May 2nd, 1519, at the age of 67, which, if you remember, I said in Paris, in 1911, or, you know, the turn of the century, just 120 years ago, the life expectancy was 50 or 60, depending on where you came from. Leonardo da Vinci was blessed with quite a long life for, you know, 1400s. On his deathbed, according to his longtime companion and a pupil of his, Vasari, he apparently said that he was repentant for a lot of things he'd done, and that, quote, he had offended against God and men by failing to practice his art as he should have done. So even at the end, you know, he was degrading himself, which is so sad because he didn't see all that he had achieved. And I'm sure, I've always thought, I bet part of him, no matter what he achieved, was never enough, because he felt he hadn't lived up to societal standards in terms of marrying. You know, generally people got married in their teens in Italy at the time, as per, you know, depicted in Romeo and Juliet and things like that. That was generally, it was around 14 for girls and, you know, 16 for boys or something. And he had always been, he'd never had like a romantic relationship. And I'm sure that part of him always, no matter what he did, it always came back to that for other people. He did all these things, and that was what the value society kind of put on him. And I think that's sad, and that's kind of a common thing. Leonardo da Vinci left a will. Now, he left the majority of his fortune, which was quite sizable at the time, including property and his existing artworks that hadn't been procured by someone else, to his pupil Francesco Melzi. He also left a longtime male servant of his a considerable amount, and a longtime companion as well, as a servant woman that worked for him, and some to his surviving brothers as well. The owner of the Mona Lisa at the time of Da Vinci's death was a pupil called Sallet, who is written quite a lot about, especially in his final decade or so. His full name was Gian Giacomo Caprotti da Oreno, and he went by Sallet or Sallai. Basically, he had been a pupil for over a decade of Da Vinci's, and Da Vinci wrote about him within months of him becoming a pupil that worked under this incredible master. And he was a very fair man, Da Vinci, and a very gentle man, a very good man. And within months, he was writing about Sallet stealing from him and lying to him. And despite all of that, he still treated him well and kept him on and allowed him to learn from him. And I think he was a very forgiving man for things that he'd gone through in his life, and had a lot of compassion. The painting, the Mona Lisa, at the time of Da Vinci's death had been valued at 505 Italian lira, which for the life of me, for about 3 hours, I tried to get the equivalent today, which is just impossible for me to find. Not only does the lira not exist in Italy since it went to the euro in 1999, but I just could not find anywhere where I was able to make the calculation of what 505 lira was at the time, with inflation and everything like that today. I think it's just too hard to do. But according to what I could find about this amount, it was a massive amount for the time. After his death, a varnish was applied to the piece to preserve it. Louis XIV moved it to the Chateau Versailles outside of Paris. And after the French Revolution, basically, Versailles was pillaged pretty bad. But the Mona Lisa was able to be kept safe, as well as quite a lot of art. And most of the hits on the royal family happened when they were in residence in Paris, not at the Chateau Versailles. So it managed to not be destroyed during, the French Revolution and everything that followed after. And when Napoleon came in, it was put in the Louvre. And as I said at the start of this episode, Napoleon was a great lover of art. And for a time before it went into the Louvre, he actually kept it in his bedroom. He liked it that much. Just, laying in his bed, eating escargot and looking at the Mona Lisa, like just chilling out. And then he put it in the Louvre, for the public to see. And that's where it was from 1797 until August 21st, 1911. But the mysteries of the Mona Lisa don't end there. Many art historians actually believe that there are two Mona Lisas, that both were done by Da Vinci. They were both commissioned by different clients, and that it's the second one that's in the Louvre. And I have no idea where they think the first one is, but some people have very strange out there theories who have worked on it for ages, and I can't discount it if that's their labor of love, finding out what happened to the first Mona Lisa. We just have no way of knowing. There's so many mysteries related to this piece, but that's not the end of her story. So when I come back in a few days, part two will focus on the theft of the Mona Lisa centuries after Leonardo da Vinci died. I don't think he ever would have thought when he was sketching out the beginning of that, and probably thinking it was quite a kind of simple piece considering the Vitruvian Man and other really complex pieces like the Last Supper that he'd done. You just can't imagine if he was alive today, or you could travel through time and tell him, this is what your piece is worth now, and this is how many people visit it a year. I think it's 100, I think it's 80 million people visit the Louvre each year, and most people go to see the Mona Lisa. Everyone kind of makes a beeline for the Mona Lisa, and, the impact of that on a man who, based on, if you believe his last words, wasn't at peace with himself, like at the end, is so sad. Yeah, I just think he was amazing. So I'll be back in a couple of days with part two. We'll focus on the theft, the search that would span years, the recovery, spoiler alert, but I mean, if you've seen it in the Louvre, you'll know that they were eventually able to recover it, thankfully. But also a number of other vandalisms that people have tried on the Mona Lisa as recently as 6 weeks ago. But also kind of a mini side story about the Mona Lisa and the Louvre in general, which is one of my favorite stories regarding World War II and Paris under World War II, and what the curators of the Louvre did to protect the art in the Louvre from being kind of pillaged by the Nazis and taken, and who knows what would have happened had they not done this. So I will be back with that, and hope that you're enjoying this bonus episode and you get something out of it. And I'll talk to you in a few days. Bye.